The National Broadcasting Company presents Clifton Utley with a commentary on the news. Here is Mr. Utley speaking from Chicago.
Good evening. By speedily recognizing the new state of Israel, the United States achieved the rather dubious distinction of having had three Palestine policies inside the past 6 months. First, we favored partition. Then, when we discovered that the Arabs were prepared to resist partition with considerable force, we immediately reached the conclusion that partition could be carried out only with the aid of substantial international forces, acting under the United Nations. And since Russia would have the power to veto the sending of any United Nations force of which he didn't approve, it stood to reason that Russia would insist on Soviet contingents being included in any peace preservation forces the UN Security Council might decide to send to Palestine to carry out partition. But as we had long since learned that Russian troops seldom left any territories where they became involved, and since we also had a pretty good idea that any Russian troops in Palestine would have side instructions to create as much unrest and chaos as possible, we quickly came to the conclusion that we could not afford to have Soviet troops included in United Nations forces that would go to carry out the partition program. Much better, so our policy leaders seemed to conclude, much better no partition at all than partition which would give Moscow a toehold in the Near East, even though that toehold was achieved as part of the United Nations force. At that point, we reversed our whole partition policy. And after an agonizing week at the UN during which it wasn't clear whether we had any policy at all, we asked the UN to abandon the partition program which we had sponsored and to create a temporary UN trusteeship over Palestine. The fundamental reason for this was a desire to keep Russian forces out of the Near East. Since there is no veto in the trusteeship council, it was conceivable that a temporary trusteeship could be set up in Palestine, whereupon the trusteeship council could then vote to send an international contingent made up, well, say, of American, British, and French troops to do the required policing. The Russians, so the idea ran, would not like being left out in the cold and having Palestine policed without aid of a contingent of Soviet troops, but since there was no veto in the trusteeship council, the most the Russians would be able to do would be to make some unfriendly speeches, and they do that anyhow. They could not either compel the inclusion of Russian forces to police a trusteeship, nor, in default of that, could they hold up the sending of an international contingent without Russian troops. This calculation was perfectly sound, except for one thing. It failed to take into consideration the fact that a number of European nations, which had not been very enthusiastic about following our partition program, for it was our program in the first place, that a number of these European nations might be even less anxious to follow our lead after we'd led the UN up the street and then back down again in the whole partition question. In fact, of course, that was what happened. When we were first arguing in favor of the partition program, various European countries warned privately that the partition scheme, were it to be enforced by the United Nations, would inevitably run into the necessity of using Russian troops in the policing contingents. These nations warned that unless we were ready to permit the Russians to get this Near East foothold, partition was a bad gamble from the United Nations standpoint. And so when their predictions about partition under the United Nations came true, and we changed the trusteeship policy, it was small wonder that a great many countries refused to follow our lead, wherefore the entire trusteeship program went into the scrap heap. Thereupon, we advised the Jewish leaders not to proclaim the independence of Israel immediately following the end of the British mandate. But since we were unable to promise the Jewish leaders any definite reward in case they followed our advice, and since by that time it was perfectly clear that the Arab countries were going to invade Palestine whether Israel did or did not declare its independence, the Jewish leaders did the quite natural thing. They declared independence the moment the mandate ended and then forced our hand. Whereupon we, acting with an alacrity exceeding even that shown by the late President Theodore Roosevelt when he recognized the Republic of Panama 2 days after a vote, in which we were not entirely free from complicity, we immediately recognized Israel. You can write your own ticket regarding the reasons. This being election year, a desire on the part of President Truman to recoup his position with the Zionist vote is obviously a factor that can't be excluded, any more than it could be excluded in the development of previous stages of our Palestine policy. But only the completely cynical would ascribe the quick Palestinian recognition primarily to considerations of our domestic electoral politics. Clearly, a major motivating factor was the fear that if we didn't move quickly, the Russians would recognize Israel before we did. And as we didn't want another case of losing the initiative to Russia, we felt we'd better move rather quickly. Quite obviously, we're by no means out of the woods yet. And equally obviously, the quixotic and apparently capricious nature of our policy in recent months is not going to inspire others, even our friends, to follow our lead in policy moves from here on. By recognizing Israel, we have climbed back on the partition bandwagon. We recognize it as an accomplished fact. Let us be fully aware of the fact that such speedy recognition of a new country is very unusual in international relations. The United States was very severely criticized internationally when Theodore Roosevelt extended his super-quick recognition in the Republic of Panama case, and then, at the same time, practically forbade the Republic of Colombia, from which Panama had revolted, to try to reconquer its revolting territory. In the present instance, where we are the one great power to have recognized Israel so far, we are bound to be under strong pressure to give additional aid, and to the extent that fortunes of war should go against Israel, should that prove the case, the pressure on the administration is bound to be doubled and redoubled. And in this connection, the importance of domestic campaign considerations in connection with the pressure cannot be overlooked. The probable next steps are, I think, quite clear. There's already been the demand from Israel that the arms embargo be removed, allowing Israel to purchase arms in the United States. The next step following will be a demand for the supplying of arms to Israel on lend-lease account. And there, we may run into some difficulties. We could represent a removal of the arms embargo as an act of neutrality and impartiality. Of course, it wouldn't be neutral because it would be designed to aid Israel. Still, our State Department could say that once the embargo was removed, both Israel and the Arab nations were both free to buy arms in this country, wherefore there was no one-sidedness. However, once we go the additional step, once we begin to supply arms to Israel on lend-lease account, then there's no longer possibility even to pretend the action is neutral. At that moment, we incur the even greater enmity of the Arab countries, and we set up a situation which clearly invites Russia to fish in the troubled waters of Arabic nations. To this, one can reply that the Arab leaders, no matter how much they may hate us, simply cannot play ball with the Russians, since the present leaders of the Arabic countries belong to the landholding classes. That is, those very classes whom the communists would be the first to dispossess and to shoot if they ever came into power in the Near and Middle East. All of which is perfectly true. But it's also true that once we become involved in lend-lease aid to Israel, thereby enabling the Russians to make effective propaganda among the Arab peoples, holding us up as enemies of the Arabs, it's also true that the Russians, once able to do that, may be capable of fomenting considerable pro-Soviet and anti-American activity among the masses in Arab nations. The net result of that could well be additional chaos throughout the Near and Middle East and more trouble for the West in getting needed oil out of the Near and Middle East regions. In connection with oil, remember this. Europe needs about 1 million barrels of Near and Mid-East oil products a day if she is to achieve the minimum necessary economic recovery. Thus, from the standpoint of defeating the Marshall Plan and of preventing European recovery, Russia does not have to take control of the Near and Middle East. It is sufficient for Russian purposes in the Near East simply to have sufficient chaos there so that oil does not flow from the Near and Middle East in sufficient quantities. Now, I realize that in raising this question of Israel asking lend-lease, I'm getting a ways ahead of the story of the moment, but probably not as far ahead as many of you listening tonight will think. And then there are many other problems that are now bound to arise. Tomorrow, the United Nations Security Council meets to consider what should be done regarding the Arab nations' invasion of Palestine. Now, if all the major nations of the UN promptly recognized Israel, as Israel requested tonight, that would create a much simpler situation. But so far, they haven't done so. One British spokesman, with a tart sarcasm directed at our American policy, said yesterday that Britain was in no hurry to recognize Israel. "There is no need to hurry," the spokesman added. "There's no election in this country until 1950. We can now foresee whether other nations... We cannot foresee whether other nations will follow our lead and give Israel quick recognition. They may be deterred from doing so simply on the grounds that our policy has been so changeable and capricious in the past, wherefore they'll want to know more about what we are, where we're likely to be leading them this time before they go along. If they fail to recognize Israel in the early future, it's possible that we and some of our normal allies will be talking at cross purposes in United Nations sessions. We asking the UN to prevent aggression against a nation that we recognize, while others show no enthusiasm for action on behalf of a country they do not recognize. And, of course, another reason for the restrained enthusiasm of other nations will be the question, what tangibly can be done to help Israel? Raising the arms embargo is one thing. Eventually, lend lease is another. But both those things can be done by the United States alone. Suppose the United Nations, however, issued a sort of cease and desist order to the Arab nations, telling them not to attack that part of Palestine assigned to Israel in the United Nations Palestine Partition Plan. And suppose the Arab nations thereupon simply laughed at the UN. Well, you'd immediately be back at the question of sending UN troop contingents to combat aggression. And when you came up to that again, you would first encounter the political opposition, particularly in an election year, which would greet any proposal to send American troops to fight in Palestine. But even if that hurdle were jumped, you would then have to face the fact that if any UN force were sent to Palestine, Russian troops would have to be included, since the decision to send such a force would have to be taken by the Security Council. And Russia, of course, would use its veto to block the sending of any force in which Soviet troops were not included. In short, we'd be right back where we were 2 months ago. So we're going to find, once the UN begins to consider what action it should take now that the Arabs actually are invading Palestine, that a great number of countries are not very anxious to do very much. First, because they can't quite see what can be done that would be effective, and second, because following our lead has led them into uncertain bypaths so many times that they aren't very anxious to follow the lead of a nation that is likely to backtrack at any moment. It's this undermining of confidence in our leadership that is the worst aspect of our whole Palestine policy. The man who said Britain didn't need to hurry to recognize Israel because Britain had no election until 1950 may have been getting off a wisecrack, but the jest reflected something more fundamental in the minds of many Europeans and many others. Russia is always preaching that come a depression, we will up and pull out of Europe, leaving the European nations to fend for themselves, which means, of course, leaving them to be devoured by Russia. So Russia says to these nations, why not line up with us now? Well, we've been successful, thanks to the Marshall Plan and various other things, in encouraging these countries to retain their independence. But when this constant Russian preachment that one day we will pull out is paralleled by a quite obviously capricious American short-run policy in the matter of Palestine, well, can you wonder that some of these countries are disturbed lest an American policy that so quickly and so often reverses itself in the short run may not do so in the long run, and do exactly what Russia says we will do, leave the rest of the world out on a limb to be knocked down by the heavy paw of the Russian bear? You saw an example of this European fear last week when the Russians published the declaration of Ambassador Smith together with Molotov's reply. We quickly recognized our statement for what it was, we in this country, simply a restatement of American policy designed to prevent Russian misunderstanding. But the Europeans, particularly the British and the French, did experience a momentary shiver of apprehension. They feared it might be the beginnings of American negotiations with Russia behind the backs of Western Europe. And behind that fear was concern lest we might negotiate a deal with Russia, leaving Western Europe out in the cold. We explained it away, and damage in consequence was minimal, but perhaps some damage remains. In sum, it all comes down to this. A great nation cannot be capricious in one part of its policy, say Palestine, without paying for such capriciousness in decreased world confidence in all aspects of its policy everywhere. It is this oneness of policy that we Americans need increasingly to bear in mind. Good night.
You have heard Clifton Utley with a commentary on the news. Mr. Utley is heard each Sunday night at this time speaking from the NBC newsroom in Chicago. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.